This is a service recording of the Unitarian Universalist Society of Oneonta, New York.
Testing. Hello. So before I come down and ask the youngest out here if they have any questions for me, I thought I would share a small story. And I may have told it before. I may not. This is back when I was an intern in Geneva. And after the service, I was in the coffee hour. And I was talking to an adult. And all of a sudden, there was a little girl pulling on my pants leg. Reverend Craig. I bent down. I said, what? I have a question. Said, okay. What's your question? They say that God made us. I said, well, some people say that, but okay. Who made God? Well, that's a pretty big question. There's lots of different answers to that question. I want your answer. Okay. Well, if God exists, and I'm not entirely sure that he or she does, but if God exists, I think we, all of us together, created God. She got this look on her face. She pinched up her face. No, that's not right. I'm going to ask someone else. And off she went to find somebody wiser, which was not entirely that hard to do. So, anyway, let's see if any of the younger folks have any questions for me. They didn't have to write them down. You have a question? No? You have a question?
Why is it so hard to think of a question?
There's a couple of answers I could get. One is, you might be so smart you don't have any questions, but I've been told that the smarter you are, the more questions you have, so maybe that's not it. The other one is, I'm putting you on the spot. You'll think of a dozen after the service. It's all right. Either of you have any questions? No questions? Okay. All right. Then what we'll do is we'll move on to the meditation, and that'll leave us more time for the written questions because there's quite a few up there. So, and if you think of one while I'm reading cards, you have special privilege. You can raise your hand, okay? All right. Because there's always good questions from the youngest ones.
Just needed 1 minute more. Just 1 minute more. You cut it short?
All right. Okay. So, how many of you have actually been to one of the question box sermons before? Better question, how many of you have not? Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, for those of you who have not been here, what I'm going to try and do is in the next 20 minutes, try to get through as many of these as I can. And as somebody has reminded me before the service, I probably will not be going into great depth with any of these, but I will do my best to be thoughtful about them, and some of these will probably become sermons. So, all right, so let's start off with a hard one right off the bat, and the question is, why does fighting in the Middle East continue to escalate? I am not an expert on the Middle East, but I kind of reject the premise of the question. I don't think it's escalating. I think it's been going on for many, 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 many years. And what happens is we get involved and we kind of put we or the British or some other country that decides that they have a better way of doing it, puts a damper on it, and then they leave and all of a sudden it blows up again. So it seems to us
like it's escalating. But I don't think it's escalating. But in answer to the other question, it's a question of resources, a question of tribalism, a question of religious factionism. I think a lot of it comes down to haves and have-nots and a belief that one group is supposed to be more privileged than the other based on hundreds of years of history. And I'm not sure how you solve that. I certainly know that you don't solve it by coming in and saying, we know a better way. That hasn't worked. And along those lines, there are a few questions here that all kind of go, these two kind of go together. Does accepting diversity mean that we will never all just get along? And is tolerance a top-down attitude? If it is, should it be promoted by UUism? So, I'm going to take the second one first. Tolerance is not a favorite word of mine. Tolerance implies you're bad or wrong, but I shall tolerate you. Nobody, what would you say to you if you were in your family and your parents said, I will tolerate you? There is very little love in the word tolerate. Accept is a much more loving word. I accept you. I accept you as being different. I accept you as being other, but I accept you. So I don't like tolerance. I'm not sure what it means to be a top-down attitude, but anything that you are trying to, if they're saying it's something that we're going to enforce from above, that never works. It has to be something you do here and up. But I think we're getting there. This kind of goes into the next part, which is, notice they said in their question, does accepting, not tolerating, accepting diversity mean we will never all just get along? I think it's exactly the opposite. I think once we all master this art of acceptance, we will all finally get along. And I have high hopes about that. I was just talking to one of the congregants earlier this week. We have, the reason that there are so many people in this country right now and around the world that are fighting so hard against GLBT issues and other diversity issues is I believe they already know they've lost. They're afraid. They're afraid of what's coming. They see the writing on the wall, and so they are frenzied in their activities to try and turn back the clock. And it's a losing battle, and they know it. If you look at the younger generations, this is increasingly not an issue with them. There are little pockets. There are little places where we've managed to instill hatred and division and factionalism into the kids. But by and large, most kids don't see this as an issue. So as the generations go, we are getting more and more accepting. The writing's on the wall. We've already won. We are going to get along. But then again, you've got, that's not everywhere. So we have to keep teaching our kids acceptance, and we have to keep encouraging people to not stay within their borders. The more we travel, the more we interact with one another, the more that acceptance spreads and the closer we get to all getting along. All right. I need a funny question here. Why set aside a separate day for questions? Can't we just ask it any time? Yes, you can always ask me a question anytime you like. However, it's kind of rude to do it while I've prepared a service for the day. Which doesn't always stop you, which is fine. But if it's off topic, I reserve the right to not answer you. The reason we reserve a day for questions is, one, this is a little fun thing to do. Two, it gives me sermon fodder for the rest of the year. And three, it kind of gives me a break during the week. I don't have to spend 20 hours preparing the sermon. I can spend 20 hours preparing for General Assembly. So that was kind of, it's self-serving a little bit, but also a lot of people enjoy it. But yeah, you can ask questions anytime you like. Last time we had one of my friends in the pulpit, I warned them ahead of time. I said, the congregation will likely behave properly, but if they like you, do not be shocked if somebody speaks back to you during the service. And they got this look on their face, and sure enough, I don't remember which one it was, but somebody said something back to them during the sermon, and they looked at me, and I said, they like you. So, all right. Why do people make life harder than it has to be? Well, my grandmother used to say it's because I thought too much. I don't know. I don't know. I guess I would. My default answer to that would probably be fear. Almost every problem we have comes back to fear. And I think we're afraid of too many things. And so then we worry about things that we shouldn't have to, and we react to things in ways that we shouldn't or don't have to. And that makes life a lot harder. So, what's the thing? We have nothing to fear but fear itself. That's not true. Bears are kind of fearful. So. Anyway. What can we do to change gun laws in this country? I'm not going to answer this one right now because this one is going to be in a month. At the service, Cain's Curse. So, tune in for that one later. When did you realize you wanted to be a minister? I was sitting in the pews of First Unitarian Society of Madison listening to Michael Schuller preach. And he was telling a story and people were listening and we'd been coming for a few months. I went, I could do that. And I thought, that is the stupidest idea you've ever had. But it wouldn't let me go. And so then I went back to this list that I'd created of possible jobs and vocations I could be. And minister had been on there, and when it had been on there, I'd laughed it off. This time I put it on the top of the list, and then I spent the next 2 years trying to cross it off the top of the list. And finally, at General Assembly in Cincinnati, I was listening to the Ware Lecture by Reverend Ford, one of the best preachers of our generation. Well, not my generation, but of our current generations. And he's not a Unitarian Universalist, but he said, what we need are human race activists. Not human rights activists, human race activists. And what he said resonated with me. And at that moment, I finally decided, this is what I really want to do. I'm going to throw away the list. And that's when it started. So, all right. Do you ever struggle with your atheism, or are you strongly entrenched in that position? I don't always identify as an atheist. I'm not firmly entrenched at all. When people ask me what I am, I say I'm a seeker. I'm constantly asking the question and checking out the answers. I think atheism is the disbelief or the not having a belief in a God. And there are plenty of times in my life where I have had that belief. And I often believe there's something bigger than us. I'm not sure if that fits under theism or deism or atheism. And then there are times where I don't believe that whatever that is, that greater than us, it has nothing to do with our day-to-day lives. It doesn't affect us. That would be closer to the deists. So it depends on who you ask. If you ask my sister, I'm an atheist. If you ask some of the people in the congregation, I'm an atheist. But other people, I'm a transcendentalist. And other days, I guess I'm a deist. I don't know. So I'm not firmly entrenched in it. But some days I am an atheist. It's a wonderful faith tradition where I can be a multiple choice person. Don't you think? I'm a little bit, I sometimes admire the people whose faith is so rock hard and strong that they never waver from it. But at the same time, sometimes they scare me. All right. Is it wrong to not care what is this? That was our meditation question. But to merely enjoy the trip through life without questioning it? No, not wrong at all. Feel free. Hope you had a good meditation anyway. All right. I'm going to move this one down further in the pile. All right. What is a good way to explain UUism and its relationship to Judeo-Christian religions? Depends on who you're talking to. But it's important, I think, for people to understand that Unitarian Universalism came out of the Judeo-Christian religions. That's our heritage. As much as some of us would like to deny that, that's where we came from. And the trick, however, and I've heard this said before, is I've heard people say things along the lines of we've evolved out of Christianity, or we left behind Christianity, or we... No, that, especially if you're talking to somebody of that faith, that's rather insulting. And it's rather insulting to the UU Christians in our midst. We as a faith tradition are no longer Christian as a whole, but that's because we kept drawing the circle wider and wider and wider and letting more and more people in to the point where we don't have a creed. We're not going to tell you what to believe, so we can't officially claim to be of any of those faith traditions. We're something unique. So I tell people that we're a non-creedal faith that came out of the Christian Judeo tradition. And a lot of the our rituals look very familiar because that's where we came from. I hope that helps. What would world peace look like? I have no idea. I sometimes look, my favorite type of genre that is not for work would be science fiction. And you'll find that a lot of science fiction writers write stories like this. Star Trek is a lot like that. They tried to envision a planet that was not at war. And then the main part of the thing was a ship that had weapons on it. So even they, in their envisioning, could not envision... They could envision the planet at peace, but they couldn't envision everywhere at peace. I don't know. It's too big for me to think of. I guess I just try to imagine what peace would look like here. And then see if maybe we can all envision that and it might spread out. All right, speaking of science fiction, here's a mind-bender one. How can we be sure humans haven't been on Earth for millions or billions of years just because scientists haven't proven it yet? Perhaps we should make some some amazing discoveries if we used our imaginations more and considered all the possibilities. First, you can't be sure. And any scientist that tells you that we're absolutely sure is not a true scientist. Scientists do not prove things. They sometimes disprove things. And I think the scientists in our midst would reject the premise that they don't use their imaginations and don't consider all the possibilities. I think it's both. That being said, I think there's a rather sizable chunk of scientific evidence that would indicate that we haven't been here for billions of years. Come back to that one. What is the best way to address the epidemic growth of greed in our land? Well, there's a rather sizable premise there, too. I do not believe that we have an epidemic of greed. This congregation shows me we don't have an epidemic of greed. Anytime I ask you for a donation for any worthy cause, you far exceed expectations in that. Walking down the street, I see people helping one another. So that's not the problem. The problem we have in our society right now is there are a small percentage of the population that seems to be infected with greed, following your own premise of epidemic. And they've managed to change the laws and tip the scales in such a way that the balance of wealth is sliding their way. They're at the top, and yet the money is running up. So there's a sizable problem in our country with disparity of wealth. And possibly the people at the top haven't figured out yet that enough is enough, or what enough actually looks like. But I don't think it's an epidemic for everybody. What's the best way to address that issue? I still think we have a democracy, although I think it's being assailed on all sides. So you have to vote. You have to look for people who recognize this disparity and are trying to fix it. And I think you keep being generous. That's the simple answer. Okay, I'm going to put that one with there. How does one make friends? Please don't say by being a friend. That's only the backside of the same question. How do you make friends? Okay, I have been blessed with the gift of making friends rather easily for a very long time. And then when I was in Milwaukee, both Cheryl and I found it exceptionally difficult and lonely. And so I had to think about this. What is it that you do to make friends? First off, you got to leave your house. You have to schedule time to be around other people. You have to be open to it. You have to listen more than you talk, usually. You have to be ready to laugh, but not at somebody. And you look for things to do that you enjoy that other people enjoy too. That's how you meet people. How you make them your friends is through repetition of presence and listening and trusting and honesty. And then if you're lucky, something develops and you make a friend. And then comes the keeping them, which is sometimes harder than making them. But it's one of the best things in life. I hope that helps. This person is clever. There's no question mark on this card. All it says is theodicy. I get this one every year. Theodicy, for those who do not know what theodicy is, it is if there is a all-powerful God. If you believe in an all-powerful God, and you believe in God as being all good, then how do you explain evil in the world? That's the classic philosophical religious question going back all the way back to the first time we thought of a divine being with so much power. I think there's no answer to that question. Matter of fact, this is the very same question that caused me to step away from Christianity when I was a teenager. This is the question I asked, and I could not find the answer to. I think that's why they went from theism to deists. And the difference between that is a theist believes in a personified God that is actually doing things on a daily basis. And a deist believes in a godlike force or somebody who has set up the universe and then walked away from it. And maybe watches, but isn't involving itself. I think it's the only way you can explain horrible things happening. You can't believe in an all-powerful God that's all good unless you resort to God works in mysterious ways, which is really not an answer. It's a cop-out. So I don't know how people who believe in an all-powerful, all-good God explain away evil. I don't think they can other than by saying it's beyond our understanding. My answer to the question was, I don't believe in that. All right. Is Christian salvation the same as Buddhist enlightenment? No, not even close. However, if you ask different Christians what salvation means, they'll give you different answers. They don't all have a really firm... It's not written out in the Bible what heaven looks like. And if you ask different Buddhists what enlightenment looks like, they will also all give you different answers. So I can tell you they're different, but I can't tell you exactly how. Although salvation usually implies your soul continues on. Well, no, see now. Sometimes salvation relates to not being dead. Salvation could be during still alive. This is a very deep question, folks. I can't answer this one right now. I'm not even sure I could answer this in a sermon. Okay. All right. What causes people to lack compassion for others? Well, I mean, we know that there are some people who are biologically affected in a way that they cannot. But I think a simpler reason, quite frankly, is I think people who have been hurt a lot sometimes can't get past the pain to show the compassion to others. I think people who've been shown compassion practice compassion. There's a second question in the card, and because it's a good question, I'm going to give you a twofer. Why is it so hard for us to accept change? Because change is scary. Because we like things the way they are. And we like not moving, you know. Cats don't like it when you move their litter box. We don't like it when people move our stuff. We don't, you know, we like knowing where everything is and everything in its place. And people fit in their little pegs and it's all very predictable. And it gives us a sense of control. We talked a lot about this in the Living with Death class, how it's very important for us to have a sense of power and agency and control in our lives, even though we don't have control over so many things. But we have an illusion of control, and change challenges our illusion of control. And so we react very poorly to it. We want things to stay the way they are, except... we don't. We actually do want things to change. We just want them to change the way we want them to change and not the way anybody else wants them to change. And we want the change to be slow and manageable. Life's not that way. All right. Another fun one. What's the meaning of life, the universe, and everything? Say it with me. 42. Thank you. All right. If not, why not? Fair enough. Why can't we get it? I don't know what it is. Why am I here? Because you're a good member of this congregation and decided to come to church. All right. So, questions I saved for later. In 5 years, where do you see UUSO going? First off, I don't see us going anywhere. I think we're pretty good right here. Do you anticipate UUSO membership increasing or shrinking? That's completely up to you. We have people coming in all the time. We have visitors all the time. We have two different colleges, universities in town with people that, quite frankly, would find this to be an amazing place. If we want to grow, we will. And if we don't want to grow, we won't. Since I've gotten here, we have done this for 5 years. And we will continue to do this unless you want to change that. And there's nothing I can do. Well, I could do things to make us go that way. But there's absolutely nothing I can do to make us go that way without your cooperation and permission. So, I don't know. Do you anticipate us shrinking or growing? Is this something we want to share with the people out there who need this, or do we want to keep it to ourselves? What's your question for the congregation? I just asked it. All right. Last questions. What would be the ideal pilgrimage for a UU? That depends on the UU. I would no sooner tell them that. However, things that come to mind, I was thinking about this when I was planning my sabbatical. A lot of ministers go to Europe and visit our Unitarian cousins there. I wouldn't mind going to see where Servetus lived and died. I tried to go to Walden last year. Last year, I tried to go walk Walden Pond, which seemed like a really good, for a transcendentalist, that seemed like a good pilgrimage. They wouldn't let me in with my dog. So instead, I walked to a different park because I know for a fact that him being a land surveyor, he walked everywhere. So I walked on the ground where Thoreau walked. It just wasn't at Walden Pond. Boston, going to Boston and seeing our headquarters, although we've changed our headquarters. We just sold the old building and moved to a new one. But there's still, I don't know. The pilgrimage, I think, pilgrimage is such a personal thing. I think you have to decide what would be beneficial to your spirit, what would be challenging, and then that's the ideal. What are you going to do on your sabbatical? For those who have not been listening or hearing me say it, for me, the sabbatical is about tending to my spiritual health. Since I started seminary, I've let go of a lot of spiritual practices. And what I've discovered is if I'm going to survive as a minister and thrive and do this for another 10, 20 years, I actually need to have those spiritual practices. And so I'm trying to pick up as many of them as I can over my sabbatical to see which ones actually still work for me. So I've got a stack of books, yay high. I used to read a book a day, and I don't read a book a month now. So I'm going to try reading a lot again. I used to write poetry. I stopped writing poetry, and I'm going to try writing poetry every day. I used to walk in the woods on a daily basis, and I haven't been out in the woods now since the class trip 2 weeks ago or the canoe trip. So I'm going to try and do that too. I'm going home to see my family and go hunting because I haven't been hunting in 4 years, and that's a spiritual practice for me. I'm going down to the National Storytelling Festival. I've never been there, but storytelling is such a big part of my ministry. I want to surround myself with experts and see what I can learn. I want to meditate. I used to really be bad at meditation, but the Life with Living with Death class taught me a little bit more about sitting meditation, so I'm going to do that. I'm going to continue to teach that class, co-teach that class next semester, even though I'm on sabbatical, because it's that important to me. I'm going to spend some time with colleagues and find out what works for them and reconnect with some of them. Some of them are going to come here and preach, and then I'll get to see them. That's my plan. I'm not really going anywhere on pilgrimage. I'm kind of going in, if that matters. What was the most inspiring book I've read in the past year? That's just it, folks. I don't read as many books as I should anymore. I'm hoping to change that. All right. I think that's it. The only one left here was how do we change bad psychological habits? And my wife is a hypnotist. She can probably help. Slowly but surely, and with great compassion and kindness to yourself. And somebody asked me a diet question. I'm hoping they weren't trying to be mean about that, but I have been working out for a month and a half now. I've lost 15 pounds. I'm really hoping that when I come back from sabbatical, I will weigh less than when I started seminary. So we'll see. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you for listening to this service recording of the Unitarian Universalist Society of Oneonta, New York. We are a welcoming congregation, accepting and affirming the lives of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people here among us. All members of the human family are welcome here. Our worship services take place every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. in our sanctuary, located at 12 Ford Avenue in Oneonta, New York. For more information about Unitarian Universalism and our congregation, please visit us in person or explore our website at www.uuso.org. This service is shared under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License.